Okay, thanks very much.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Thanks for coming. It's been really interesting, I think, being in this room today, and also I was here in the equivalent room last year. And there's a lot of different aspects of funding of open source, and I think this aspect of how research software gets funded is a little bit different than some of the others, but it's probably just my personal view, because I think probably everybody is going to say that the way their software is funded is different than all the others. But I'm going to go ahead and start talking about this research software specifically. I just do want to mention also that there's two co-authors, Eric Jensen and Michelle Barker. Neither of them were here, but they were contributors to the work overall. So just to start off, it's worth introducing research software because it's a part of open source, and sometimes it's not open source, but mostly it is. There were a group of us that in 2021 ended up finishing a long discussion where we tried to define what research software meant, and we published a report on the process with a bunch of different examples. And basically what we said is that research software is source code files, algorithms, scripts, workflows, etc., created during the research process or for research purpose. And people that are doing research are also using other software. They're using things like operating systems and libraries, and their software has lots of dependencies. And these are things that are used for research, but they weren't created during or with a research intent. And so we would say that these are software in research as opposed to research software. And this varies between disciplines. So if I am a computational astrophysicist and I'm modeling black holes, the compiler that I use to compile my C code, for example, is not research software. It's software in research. But if I'm a computer scientist and I'm trying to build the next generation of compilers, that same compiler might be research software. So it's a little bit of a fuzzy definition, unfortunately. We've never been able to come up with a crisp one. And so we could argue about this. If anybody's interested in research software, I'm happy to talk about this, and you can tell me why this is a bad definition, and I won't necessarily disagree with you. But it's not clear that there's a better one. And there's I would say in talks where I discuss this and other people discuss this, there's often a desire to have a community effort to try to come up with a better definition. And I'd be happy if that happened. I just am doubtful that it's going to do anything that'll be much different. Okay. So if we now have research software, and if we talk about this from the point of view of the researcher, research software is usually developed by a researcher who needs it. They do it because they need it in order to solve their research problem. This is scratching their own itch. And maybe that's the end, is that they develop their software for themselves and they solve their problem and nothing else happens. But maybe they also archive this for reproducibility, so people in somewhere else in a few months, in 10 years, can do the same research and understand where these results came from. And maybe that's the end. Or maybe that researcher then says, okay, I've solved this problem, but now I have another problem, and I have to modify the software to be able to solve that next problem. I have to put in new physics. I have to put in a new method of looking at a new biomedical scanner or something else. And maybe that's the end. Or maybe the software is actually going to be used by other people, which is really, in some ways, what we, I think, as a community would like, not necessarily what the person that builds it likes. And maybe that's the end. And if we do that, then ideally we get a community that forms around that software. We get other people that are using it. They're suggesting features. They're creating issues. They're finding bugs. Maybe they're even contributing to it with pull requests, something like that. Maybe they're just going out and telling other people that they should use it and that they should work together to build it. In this situation, there's often somebody that takes on responsibility for maintaining the software. I know this is kind of obvious open source, but in research, it's kind of an odd thing that happens because it's somebody whose goal is to do research, and now they're not going to do research. Instead, they're going to try to maintain their software. And so it certainly happens, but sometimes it happens consciously. Sometimes it happens kind of just along the way. Ideally, it's done intentionally by somebody that's experienced and knows how this works, and they're choosing to do this at the expense of their other activities because they see this as the best thing for the community or the best thing for themselves. And this then ideally leads to reusable community research software. And this is, I think, where we would often like to get to. From the point of view of somebody that's really a developer, that's not a researcher, but somebody that sees a common research problem, And they likely have some experience within or next to other researchers that have this problem. They develop a tool that addresses it. This is a project that I've worked on that's a workflow system named Parcel that Ben Clifford in the back is our maintainer for this is a kind of an example of this. The developers then work with researchers to test and improve the software. They try to form a community or to develop some other method for sustainability. And this is, again, usually done intentionally by somebody experienced. And this is somebody that could do other things, but they feel like supporting this area of research and building this tool that's going to enable that is important. And again, this ideally is then going to lead to reusable community research software if everything goes well. So from the point of view of a funder, and I should say here, this is a funder who's interested in supporting the research primarily. So this is often a government agency, it can be a philanthropy, it can be a business if that research software is of interest to that business. It isn't often so much, but it certainly is in some cases in the financial industry, for example. They see multiple researchers that are working in similar areas that often would benefit from sharing software and having reusable community software. They don't want to support multiple people who are doing research in the same area, each of whom is going to write very similar software for that research. They would much rather see that happen in a community because it's cost effective for them. And they should be supporting researchers then who choose to make their software into reusable community software. And they should be supporting developers who want to create reusable community software. And so what I'm going to be talking about is this situation, right, where we're aiming to get to reusable community software. I'm not going to talk about the vast amount of research software that's built by one person for their own research and that's the end. It never gets shared or it gets archived. That's important, but it's not really the focus that I have. So if we then look at the funding processes, we have the fact that resources are needed to maintain software. That's, again, I think obvious to everybody from all the talks that we've had already in this session. Those resources can come from users, and that's clearly the case when you have commercial software where the users are paying the developers effectively for the software. Or in theory, it can come from other models. It can come from people that are contributing their time, people that are contributing small amounts of money, grant funding. These things are all more difficult, but they can happen. It can come from the developers. So somebody who's getting funded to do the research puts some of their research time into the software, and they need the software in order to do their research. They keep doing this. So it's their choice of how to do this. Or it could be that an institution, say a university or a national lab or a research center, sees the software as something that's really important to them and it's part of their reputation. And so they are going to put some money into supporting it as well. And that happens occasionally, but not very often. And then it can come from a third party, a funding organization that can be a government or a philanthropy or industry. And again, this is the part that I'm going to focus on, is where we've got this third party activity that's bringing in the resources for the research software. And so today we have multiple grant making organizations. Just the last talk was another one that I wasn't aware of, not necessarily for research software, but potentially maybe there's a research software piece that could come out of that as well. And there's multiple projects that are seeking grants. There's probably, I don't know, thousands, tens of thousands, I'm not sure how many, maybe even hundreds of thousands of research projects that would like to have better support than they have. So right now, each project has to be aware of which organizations exist that could support their project and write proposals to them. And again, this isn't specific to research software, but it is the main thing that happens within research software. These projects then also have to be aware of all the policies of those potential funders, including rules that they may have against duplicate submissions and against getting multiple awards for the same work. So they have to create different proposals that are somewhat different from each other in order to avoid having these issues, even though they're really looking for funding just to do one thing often. And so this is difficult and time-consuming for projects, and it's not really very efficient at all. Funding organizations, which I'm just calling funders very often, decide which submissions they're going to support. And the means that they use for this is typically peer review. They bring together a bunch of peers, either software developers or software users, and they get them to give opinions of what's the quality of this proposal, what's the importance of it, And again, this is often within a peer review process, but sometimes it happens in a different way, particularly for philanthropies. Some funders, and this is particularly the case for philanthropies, will approach projects directly. So the funder says, I'm funding work in computational chemistry. It's very clear to me that this chemistry package is being used by a bunch of my researchers. I'm going to go out and reach out to the developers and ask them what they need to make sure that that package stays around. And that's really nice when it happens, but again, is somewhat rare. And it's also good for well-known and well-connected projects, and it's bad for other projects because they don't really have a way of getting into that funding at all. And so overall, there's no coordination that happens of all these different funders, and this isn't efficient for anybody. And then in addition, projects have dependencies, and the funder decisions often don't account for these dependencies. So they fund the application that somebody uses, but they're not aware that that application actually is dependent on a bunch of other packages that aren't research software and are not being supported, even though if any of them went away, there would be a lot of problems. Okay, from the point of view of projects, so research software projects typically begin under a fixed duration grant. In the US, this is usually 3 to 5 years, maybe 2 years. Depends on where you are, but there's usually some duration after which the funding's gonna end. And the project then has to find resources for development and maintenance when the grant ends. And sometimes the grant asks the project to give some idea about how they're gonna do this at the beginning and to start thinking about it from the beginning, which is certainly better than not thinking about it until you've run out of money, but both happen. And this becomes then an ongoing process for most software projects. They have grant funding that's coming in for staff. They often have some volunteers, some collaborators, some other people, and they need to do a bunch of work. And that work includes developing and maintaining the software itself, doing the documentation, doing testing, and then a bunch of different community work, aspects of community work like user support, supporting community development, doing outreach, things like that. Small projects have times when there's a grant and they can do all of these things, and times where there's no grant and they really have difficulty doing any of these things. And large projects often can have some staff who are dedicated to sustainability, and because they have those people, they can stay in these smooth periods more often and be more likely in these grant periods. And there's been a bunch of work that's happened around software project life cycles, and so I just wanted to point out one recent paper that I was on that Yo Yehudi led, and she's a person who's led a lot of this work, that proposes a life cycle model for